So I'll start off without an angry comment. One of the nice things of doing this show and not having just to revert to straight shock radio is that we really can try to elevate the debate and the fascinating people we come across. Last night, we really covered the waterfront with the young man named David Zand, who's setting up Red Friday demonstrations. Victor Davis Hanson was on about the American election. John Turley Ewart, deputy editor of the National Post, talking about Darfur. We're going to have the same kind of evening tonight. Tom Velk will be with us, head of the Department of Canadian Studies at McGill, an economist, talking about, of course, the income trust issue today. Jim Hughes, head of the Old Brewery Mission, on his new strategies for expanding not only the brewery's services, but for helping people on the streets. And we're going to start off with one of my favorite people and one of the most trenchant observers of where Canada is going, Barbara Kay, who's a National Post columnist. We're going to talk a bit more about the conference that we had last week that the Institute put on, Questions of Values, and she had a fascinating take on it in the National Post today. And for full disclosure, yes, we invited a lot of media, but we invited her to meet with the speakers. And the result was that if you read her piece in today's National Post, The Truth Unveiled, you could understand that we're a country that knows the price of everything, but maybe we don't know the value of anything. And we've got to be headed in that direction. Barbara, welcome.
Hi, Darryl. Nice to be here.
Excuse me. You leveraged the issue of the niqab as a metaphor for what these women had to say in their courage to Canada. I think you should tell our listeners about it because it was a fascinating take on it.
I came to this subject, honestly, even though you invited me to this conference as media, I was thrilled to come because I'm very troubled by the whole, what the niqab controversy represented to me. And it seemed to me that people's attitudes to the niqab kind of crystallize their whole position on just exactly what we are facing in terms of an Islamist threat. Are we facing one or not? Those who feel that the niqab is, just another form of religious costume or dress, we shouldn't take it seriously, just another piece of diversity on the multicultural scene. And then there's those like me who see the niqab as extremely socially aggressive and as a political and ideological message that is hostile to the West and that we should take extremely seriously and not just sort of step aside and say, well, you know, it's just another, you know. So I had already written on that. I feel very strongly about it. So I was very intrigued to meet these fabulous women who have a kind of courage I think we see rarely in the West today, who must be respected just for the fact that they've put themselves out there and have endured the kind of threats and honest threats to their persons, and so they deserve our respect just for that. But they went way beyond my expectations in terms of in terms of delivering a message and actually galvanized the people that were there. I've heard from many of the people, by the way, at the conference who were there, who said that they walked out of there kind of feeling almost
empowered.
Yes.
And we got a lot. We shared a lot of the email. And I want to talk to you about these two issues: the issue of empowerment. But I was caught by the issue of separatedness, not just on the issue of Islam, but as Canadians and what we've dealt with. And I want to go into that issue with you. But right after we pay some bills and, of course, have our vaunted traffic check.
So,
Barbara,
okay.
Be patient with us. We'll be right back, Montreal. And we're talking with Barbara Kay about her very, very trenchant column today, The Truth Unveiled in the National Post on the conference that was held last week by the Institute of Public Affairs called Questions of Values, Ways of Response to the Islamist Challenge. And Barbara, before the break, we were talking about the question of dress and the question of separateness. And your article got me thinking. We have spent a generation, maybe two in Canada, talking about political separation, talking about how no nation should be built strictly on ethnic considerations, certainly not a nation like Canada that was basically started as an economic experiment 400 years ago. And yet we're willing to accept separatedness of communities, separateness of individuals. We're willing to bow down to every parochial particularity at the same time that we're fighting to celebrate our common universalities politically. Is this a form of national schizophrenia?
Yes, in a word.
It struck me as I was reading this. I was about to say to you today, we've talked several times, I said, Barbara, the next column's got to be about, well, okay, so what is this nation business that we're talking about for Quebec? Is this kind of a national niqab?
We're schizophrenic in the same way ideologically as, for example, feminists are schizophrenic in that they will pound the pavements and beat their fists bloody on the courthouse doors in order to make sure that women in Canada are getting equal pay and equal prestige with men.
Not just equal, parity, as George Jones wrote.
Parity. Or let's say more than parity, but let's not go there. Let's just say that they'll knock themselves out silly for Canadian women. They are totally silent on the rights of women in places where women really could use their help. And it's the same thing with other cultures. It's fair game. Let's say Christian women walked around with veils over their faces. You can be sure that the criticism would be flying thick and furious. But because it's another culture and a culture that involves women from exotic places and dark-skinned women, we just fall on our knees and say, oh, but we can't judge. It's not for us to judge other cultures.
Yeah, we've got this attitude of everybody's got a right to be wrong except the West.
Exactly.
And, you know, one could even expect that from, oh, I don't know, a people of imperial historical background. The British had an empire. The French had an empire. We were colonized, not colonizers.
Exactly.
You'd think we'd be able to see straight.
You would think so, but we don't. Politically correct covers it all. If men walked around veiled or with their faces hidden, there would be a huge outcry. It would be banned. It seems to me it might be a good idea for 100 men to start walking around with their faces veiled and see the reaction they get. Put on some ski masks and see what happens. The niqab is an extremely hostile garment, and clothing is a statement. Clothing is a flag. If these women were walking around with Hezbollah flags, we would be upset. Some of us would be. But that niqab is basically, it's a big sign saying, I support jihadism and Islamism.
It's a political statement indeed. You had a wonderful turn of phrase that I want everybody to hear who might not have read the column. Liberals, and I presume you're meaning smaller liberals, would have us believe the niqab is the cultural equivalent of a Mennonite bonnet.
Exactly.
I love that.
Well, first of all, that is an extremely superficial statement, and that was said in this McLean's, my column today started out as a critique of a McLean's editorial, which actually distressed me because McLean's has done a turnaround since Ken White took it over, and I wouldn't think a person of Ken White's intelligence would have either written or condoned an editorial of that kind of superficial and flippant almost. Assessment.
You use words of a Ken White that Barbara Amell used with me. I'm beginning to think he might have been on vacation.
Well, I'm hoping he was on vacation because I have such respect for him that when I saw that editorial, I said, hey, you know, did some graduate from Carleton Journalism School take over the newsroom or something? I couldn't get over. And it upset me more than 100 Toronto Star editorials where I would expect that kind of jejune and childish approach to this subject. The Mennonite bonnet, the Hasidic, pious and the religious garb, these are long-standing and, by the way, bilateral garments. In other words, they are codes of sexual modesty, but the men also wear them. And they've been around for a long time. They have no political importance whatsoever. The niqab has been adopted only in the last, say, 10 years, and it has been adopted as an ideological garment.
Is there possibly a middle ground, and the middle ground would go something like this, the middle ground argument. Wear what you want, cover what you want, but we as a nation in our public life, whether it's the military or the police, anything that serves the public is not going to pander to those particularities. In other words, no more, you know, no more yarmulkes, no more headdresses for Sikhs, no more ceremonial daggers. You want to be an RCMP officer, you want to be a soldier, you want to be a police person, you want to be a judge, you stick to that, the French modèle républicain of an absolute firewall between state and faith.
We're totally on the same page here. I am not a big fan of France, and I've been an outspoken critic
right.
of France. Not my favorite country in terms of its political history, but on this particular question, they got it right. I don't want to see...
Of course, the guy who got it right, Nicolas Sarkozy, is an opponent of Jacques Chirac, who practices duplicity the way other people
well,
take
under,
showers.
Yeah, but under Chirac, the hijab was still banned in school because
yep.
they understood
yes.
the hijab to be a political statement as well as a religious statement. And I would say ban hijabs in school, ban all religious garments in school, in public schools. Anything that's tax-funded, ban it. No religious garments whatsoever. You know, I personally don't think a little kippah or a little gold cross at the throat is meaningful. But if that's the price we have to pay to get rid of all this other stuff, I'm willing to see it happen.
Barbara, would you have time to stay with us? I want to
sure.
ask you one final question, but we've got to go to a short break.
Sure.
Thanks. We'll be right back, Montreal.
Okay.
We're talking to National Post columnist Barbara Kay, and yes, I'm going to be a shameless self-promoter, but as Churchill said, I am one, but nobody can do it as well. She wrote a fantastic article called The Truth Unveiled, where she drew themes from a conference of the Institute for Public Affairs last Wednesday. Barbara, one final question, and this goes back to something you said at the beginning about women, and women who fight for women's rights here, but when it's abroad, it's not there. One of the speakers at the conference, Nazanin Afshinjan, who's fighting the battle for the life of Nazanin Fateha, a young 18-year-old girl sentenced to death in Iran for stabbing her rapist, ended her talk with four words. Si vous pouvez, vous devez. If you can, you must. And she says, what are the ways of response? Get involved. Speak out. Do something and people pay attention. Even one letter, one call to somebody can start a move going. The people of Canada, never mind the women of Canada, because the women are the spokespeople, frankly. You know, somebody asked me, how come all the speakers are women? I said, well, because they're there. I don't particularly care if they're one-legged dwarfs living in the same building, if they're the best and the most courageous.
They also have the most to lose under Israel.
Yes, exactly. But have we got the right stuff in this country for individual initiative anymore?
We have the right stuff in select little clusters. We don't have the right stuff in our marrow. And one of the reasons that is you need a critical mass in order to make a country brave. You need a rock-solid grassroots group that doesn't waver on moral issues. And that, I'm afraid, is something we need to build up because there just aren't enough. There's plenty, but... You know, you really need more than letters to the editor and little groups huddled in the rain like you guys did, you know.
Right. Well, we're going to have a Red Friday rally on this Friday again.
And tell your listeners to look for the National Post tomorrow when a very interesting op-ed you wrote is going to appear. And
Now they'll really accuse us of doing a tag team. We might as well, you know, do the Kay Wiseman report. What the hell?
I just want to sell more National Post.
Absolutely. I said to John Turley Ewart last night, if we didn't have the National Post, we'd lose the storehouse of reason and sanity.
I'm trying to sell more, and you happen to be in it tomorrow, and it's a good reason to read it.
Thank you, Barbara Kay.
My pleasure.
A good evening.
Okay.
Well, Montreal, one person who has the right stuff on an issue that's really critical in this town is our next guest, James Hughes, director of the Old Brewery Mission. Welcome, Jim. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Pleasure to be here.
You've been with us before, not nearly enough, but I want you to talk tonight about your new strategies to expand the mission and not just providing beds and not just being reactive, but being proactive to what's happening on our streets.
Well put. That's I really like the way you've framed the question. In the past, is exactly what we've done. We've reacted to the demand for humanitarian services. You know, people arriving at the door in hundreds and hundreds every night, saying, "I need a bed, I need a meal, I need a shower, I need some clothing, I need some help, because I got nowhere else to go." And for over 100 years, we've said yes. Come on in. We're going to take care of you. But, you know, in the last 15 years, as you know, Beryl, we've tripled the number of beds we have. We're 488 beds under management now. It's a big place.
Yep, you've got a whole bunch of locations just to get a number of the Old Brewery Mission. The operators at Information go a little crazy.
Yeah, well, apologies to them, but we've grown to meet the demand, but now we've just asked ourselves whether we're necessarily growing in the right ways, and for the last 2 years we've been scratching our heads about what is the best way not to simply accommodate people within homelessness by providing these types of humanitarian services, because remember, they come back day after day after day. At a certain point, it's no longer humanitarian.
You're saying it becomes a way of life?
Exactly. And so we've put into place a 5-year plan to say we're gonna try something else. We're not going to abandon by any means what we've done in the past. We're going to continue to provide that safe sanctuary we always have. But now we're going to add a different kind of service, which is basically a case management service, where we're going to say, listen, who are you? What are you doing here? How has your journey led you here? And how can we help your journey out of here on a permanent basis? And that is...
Jim, hold the explanation. We just have to have a short break here, and we'll come right back with you, and we're going to discuss in depth just what this involves.
Perfect.
We'll be right back with Jim Hughes, Old Brewery Mission, right after this. And you can email us with your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. And we're talking with one of Montreal's heroes, Jim Hughes, head of the Old Brewery Mission, who's announced a new 5-year strategic plan. And Jim, before the break, you were using those famous words, case management. Now, case management, of course, brings up visions of social workers, bureaucrats, but I don't think that's your plan.
No, we kind of call it shelter case management. It's case management light because, we're not the ones whose job it is to, we think, cure what ails the hundreds of people who come through our door. Our job is really to take homelessness out of the healing equation. People who have schizophrenia or depression, as you know, their lives and their ability to heal is made much more difficult by living a homeless life. So take homelessness out of that, get housed in an appropriate setting with stable revenue and a treatment plan, you get a much better chance at contributing to your community and to yourself again.
This means more people, more staff,
yeah,
more
exactly.
funding?
Exactly. It's going to require for sure more professional type staff on the floor who are ready to, as I say, not just guide and the men and ladies to their beds and ensure they get their right. showers and so on. It's to really sit down and have that conversation, which lets us know where the next step should be and accompany them on that journey out.
The funding is coming from private sector. I know you have a very active board, or is the government stepping in?
Yeah, well, it's a 5-year plan. It's going to take some time to, for sure, develop the kind of resources that we'll need to put it into place. We've already started, though. We already have some early successes. Last year, with a fairly bare-bones professional-type staff, we were able to help 106 people out of homelessness.
Mm.
That's documented. We have, unfortunately, though, 1,200 new people who were banging on the door for services. So the difference is fairly important. So it's going to be financed for sure, public and private, and it's going to take a lot of time to do it.
And of course, I just want to remind the listeners out there who sometimes casually pass by people, there's a fine line. It's a razor's edge that separates any of us from our current circumstances to much worse circumstances. And you mentioned people who are schizophrenic, who have psychological disorders, but the nature of our society, the economic nature of our society, can tip the balance so quickly that it makes people's heads spin. And, at the Institute, we get a lot of cases of people who are up against governments or have been badly done by corporations. And the triage is the most difficult part. I'm reminded of one case of a mother who two kids, husband wasn't paying support, she was on welfare, had forgotten to file her tax return. So because she'd forgotten to file her tax return and finally filed it, with zero, of course, the government still said to her, well, it's going to take us 3 months to process it, and that time you're not getting any child allowance checks or anything else. And this woman was literally one step away from being on the street. And I went to see her, and you have to check up and verify the situation, and then you call the appropriate people in government, and you basically, the from what our side, what we do is basically say, okay, look, either you fix this and cut to the bureaucracy, or you'll have a press conference tomorrow. But you can't do that in every one of your cases, can you? Especially with 30,000 homeless in Montreal, and a federal study recently that showed that one-third of Montreal Island households are living below the federal poverty line.
Yeah, those are really alarming statistics. And you're absolutely right. You look through the clientele that we see every day and throughout the year. There's tremendous talent. There's tremendous ability that's fallen into the trap of homelessness because of one event, the loss of a loved one.
Right.
A critical income gap that was created because of a late filing, as you say, or something like that, and all of a sudden, bang, they have to bang on the door of places like the Old Brewery, which, of course, is not doing this alone. The Welcome Hall Mission is doing tremendous work, the Maison Super, and the wonderful work done by the women's shelters as well, and others. It takes a community to reduce homelessness, and that's one of the big themes that we have, is that we have to do this together. But we have to be audacious about it too, or else the
problem. But all this what you're describing, Bobby Kennedy called them the thousand centers or the hundreds of centers of energy and daring. And you sometimes look, at least I sometimes look, and I say there's so many good people out there who are trying to force this society to be a society of compassion and not of contempt, to value cooperation as much as competition. And then you look at our governments who are running between the raindrops, who dare not care, who can't tell right from wrong anymore, cannot address the real political and distributive issues that must be addressed, and occupy themselves with little statocratic engineering. And don't you just want to take all these groups and march into the streets one day?
Well, interesting. You mentioned the poverty statistic. There's almost 5 million people in this country who are living below the low income cutoff, the poverty line.
Yep, we've done work with food banks. 6 million Canadians every week take advantage of food banks. Somebody once wrote, "We're a very rich country with a thin veneer of affluence." But Jim Hughes, as long as they're the Jim Hughes of the world, I won't be completely angry all the time. And Jim, anytime you need anything and anytime you have a new initiative, the airways are yours. And we hope to see you during Christmas week. We're planning a whole series of programs, at least I am, on those that aren't having a Merry Christmas and how that season even makes it worse and more troublesome. So we hope to have you back, if not then, before then at least then.
Well, you're wonderful. That's very, very kind.
Jim Hughes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Montreal, we'll be right back. We're about to get into the discussion of what some people would consider an esoteric economic question, but it's not. It really goes to the bottom line, and it goes to the bottom line of tipping people over the edge into the hands of the Jim Hugheses and the Old Brewery Missions. As a nation, our resources are limited, and our financial resources are limited, and they're being squandered politically. So as you're going to listen to this fascinating discussion with our next guest, if you're one of these people on the edge, if you're one of the people that Jim Hughes serves, we want to hear from you and do a point-counterpoint with the kind of discussion we're going to have. Now, the story of the day, of course, has been income trusts. What are they? Why do so many people consider them bad for the country? What has it done to fiscal equity? We're not talking about parity, but tax equity. And it's my pleasure to welcome back an old mentor, though we're not that far apart in age, so I won't age you, Tom, but Professor Thomas Velk, who's director of Canadian Studies at McGill and an economist of note and a commentator that you've seen frequently. Tom Velk, welcome to the show.
Well, glad to be here, Beryl, and we're not that far apart in age. We don't assure that to the audience, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay, so income trusts, images, big corporations sheltering income retroactively, bad thing. We even heard it from people at the C.D. Howe Institute. What's the problem with income trusts?
Well, the real problem with the whole tax structure in the country is that the tax structure is so bloody complicated that nobody really knows how much taxes they're paying. Nobody feels those taxes. I have, if anything, a kind of a soft spot in my heart for income trusts, because to the extent that they move taxes downstream to the individual who actually pays them, in other words, an income trust allows the money to flow through a corporation without any tax being paid on it. By the time you get it as a real human being, then you pay the tax. I think that basic idea is a good idea because then the real human beings who get hit in the nose for big government know how hard they're being hit. And also it's a way to diminish the complexity of the tax field. I'm a kind of a, I'm a flat tax guy and also a low tax guy. And I guess I'm a little bit disappointed with the government if the intention here is to increase the aggregate quantity of taxes they take away from us and make it harder to figure out how much taxes we're really paying, and in that sense help feed the beast, which is, as far as I'm concerned, big government.
What would be so bad if the government simply said, and it's enough. It's really enough. You and I were talking about this afternoon, and I said to
right.
you, when we first met, or no, a little bit later, after I finished law school, the tax code of Canada was 450 pages. Today it's 1,180. Now, this is a government that's committed to rolling back state interference in our lives. This is a government that says it's Main Street, not Bay Street, and it has been the Liberal Party that has been Bay Street, and political labels don't matter anymore. What if they just said no? No, Mr. Corporation, you want to be a personne morale, as they're known in Quebec? You want to be a moral person as an entity? Fine. You're going to be treated just the way we treat individuals. So we go to your idea of a, perhaps not a flat tax, but at least an equitable treatment of all tax paying possibilities.
Well, that's right. I certainly want a flat tax, and I want everybody to pay more or less the same amount of tax. But I maybe you and I have a small difference here, not certainly of fundamental principles, but of the I see a corporation just really as a stack of papers. It's not a, it's a moral person. I don't even know what that means. But
oh, that's something that they have worked for long and hard to establish, that they are to be treated. A corporation is to be treated as a human being, as an individual, to take advantage of all the rights that an individual has to exploit the wealth and the benefit of a society. The only part that corporate lawyers and corporate law has veered off into is trying to get them treated differently on the tax side.
Well, that's right.
And corporations want to be treated as moral persons, as a real individual.
What at least the they of a corporation is a hard thing to pin down, but I see a corporation as just an entity that represents a collection of interests. There's customers, there's stockholders, there's the people, the worker bees and the managers. Too often managers of corporations act as if they are the persons who should benefit from the existence of a corporation. They pay themselves excessively high salaries. They protect themselves when they screw up. And I think we can fault them for that. But at the end of the day, the tax burden in particular that's laid on a corporation falls on either the customers or the workers. I mean, the taxes the corporations pay either drive down the wages of the workers, or they drive down, or they drive up the prices that customers have to pay, or they drive down the returns of the stockholders. And the real strategy, I think, the long-run strategy of government ought to be to move every tax that imaginable down to real human beings, to us.
Right.
Now, that sounds perverse, but of course I see this as a
no. But it's not perverse if there's a flat tax.
That's right. And at the end of the day, I see this as a political process. Once we understand how terribly much tax we pay when those taxes come down to us, then the roar will go up from the population, and it will demand that government both flatten those taxes in two senses, make them uniform across persons and diminish them in total.
Now, we have to get into this after we're just going to take a short break, but the flat tax works as long as at the same time you eliminate all the dérogations, all the special private members' bills that have been in the Senate that allow corporations and shareholders of corporations to get around a lot of these things. And I want to get
right.
into that with you right after this break.
Okay, bro.
And we're talking about income trust and creating a more equitable tax structure with economist Professor Tom Velk, who's head of the Department of Canadian Studies at McGill University. Tom,
Right. Very small correction. I'm head of North American.
North American Studies. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to have the narrow Canadian focus.
That's right. This is a big. I'm bigger than just.
You are.
Hey.
And we are. Okay. I'm gonna head into an area where I'm going to give you half the information, and you're going to be play professor and tell me why you're giving me an F in this, right?
Okay.
In 2004, I hired a bunch of researchers, and we at the Institute did a study. I wanted to know where the money was. I mean, we're a country that goes so crazy over $5,000 that I want to know where the money's going. And this is what we found for 2003.
Mm-hmm.
Corporate Canada. And don't stop me until I finish all the numbers. It's
okay.
Like two columns.
No, sure.
Corporate
okay.
Canada that year took in a gross of $2.3 trillion, on which their pre-tax profit was $390 billion, on which they paid federal taxes of $21-odd billion. Now, the other side of the ledger. Working Canada, from chairman of the board to street sweepers, made about $550 billion in gross salary and paid $77 billion to the federal government in taxes. So, working Canada, comparing salaries to profits, not to gross revenue, working Canada was making about 20% more and paying 350% more in taxes. Now, second set of facts and last set of facts. In that year, the federal government spent $46 billion on outright, out of a $180 billion federal budget, on outright loans, which 92% were not repaid, and complete grants to corporations, and spent only $39 billion on UIC welfare and pensions. Something about these numbers makes me queasy and real angry. Should I be angry or not?
Well, you should be angry at the immense size of that tax burden that falls upon all of us, one way or another, and you should be angry that the government has concealed the sources much more efficiently than your numbers suggest, because there are all kinds of ways. That we are burdened.
Can I open parentheses there? Because we also have to be mad at the waste of idiotic programs that governments involve themselves in. Do you know how we got this information?
How did you do it?
You can't. Canada used to publish something called InfoSource. They stopped in 1996. Huge book, told you where the government was spending the money. Now you've got to go to a site in the Ministry of Finance website, which in itself is hard to find, and you get to ask a series of 96 questions off a tab, and for every question you got to have your Visa card because you have to pay $3.
You got to pay, right?
$3 to ask what the government is doing with your money.
In your pocket, yeah. $3 to find out how deep their hands.
You don't know how right you were. I just had to tell you that story.
Yes. Well, of course that's right. But the only quibble that I'd raise with you, Beryl, is that the assumption is that these corporations are somehow separate from us as workers, as customers, and as stockholders, because that tax burden that the corporations face, as you say, as a percentage, it's smaller than the burden that we pay as people. But we as people are really paying that corporate tax one way or another, either because our returns as investors are less, our payments as a worker is less, or our prices as customers are higher. So that tax that apparently is laid on the corporations is at the end of the day pushed to us. We're the only, I mean, there's no man from Mars absorbs taxes. We human beings are at the end of the day the only real taxpayers in this economy. And that's the point that is, I think, important to get across. And the second thing is, I certainly agree with you early on about this, the immense length of the tax code and the way special members bills, what have you, weasel things so that we are, at least as individuals, from time to time deceived about how heavy our burden is. Or if we are powerful and influential and have a friend in government, we have, in fact, a truly lighter burden than our neighbor does. But that's, as I see it, just another way, what's really the real word.
Another part of the problem.
That's right, and it is at the end of the day corrupt that you can weasel your way around this burden as an individual, but it tricks us into complacency into saying, well, you know, it's not so bad. I've got a deal. If Beryl doesn't have a deal, too bad for him. And that's of course destructive of good citizenship as well as everything.
Absolutely. Tom Velk, as long as we have voices like yours, we're going to keep on having good citizenship. And I want to have you back with your other hat on North American Studies to discuss the potential for a new North American Union. And we want to do that in the next couple of days if you've got the time.
Here, here. Let's do it.
Thank you, Tom Velk.
Okay, bro. Bye-bye.
A lot of issues out there, and I want to remind everybody of one thing. Until we have a society where the worker can deduct his sandwich at work just like the executive can deduct his lunch, and when the worker's H&R Block bills can be deducted as easily as the businessman's accounting, we're not going to achieve that parity of society, that equality of society, that society of compassion that we all need. Montreal, we'll be back with you tomorrow night. Nick Mays, Master Control, thanks very much.